May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Jim Whitwer, representing the appellants, the trail users in this case. With me at council table is my co-counsel, Emma Schultz. This morning, this court and this division again address important issues under the open meetings law in the era of electronic communications. Here, the violations of that law occurred not only in electronic meetings via email, they also occurred by telephone and in person. The questions before you today relate to what is to be done after OML violations have occurred. Our first question is the cure versus rubber stamp question. If this court holds that an agency violating the act may cure the violations and thereby suspend the prescribed invalidation remedy found in subsection 402(8) of the act, and this court's corollary rule prohibiting rubber stamping of decisions discussed during the illegal meetings. If a cure is available, under what circumstances is it available? The trail users believe that at a minimum, a successful cure of violations must include two things. First, a board's unequivocal admission of the violations, including full disclosure of the circumstances, and two, new and substantial reconsideration at a subsequent public meeting.
Did that take place in this case?
No, Your Honor. In neither case. Obviously, the admission did not occur until the Parks Board filed its answer to the complaint in this case.
Are you aware of any precedents that stand for the proposition that the party has to admit the violation as a prerequisite to a cure?
Well, I would say one of two things has to happen. There needs to be a finding. Let's see, as prior to cure, I believe that it is the only way that will actually preserve the intent of the act to increase transparency, because without, if you couple that with cure defeating the right to recovery of attorney fees, then there will be no ability for the public to investigate and discover the violation.
My question was simply whether that requirement is one that is supported by any case law, either in Colorado or in the out of state.
Cure? No.
Okay, thanks.
The issue is, as you mentioned, relevant to the attorney fee award, whether or not the body admits the violation. Isn't that true?
I believe one of two things have to happen in order to terminate attorney fee liability. I'm not sure if that's the question, but I'll answer it and see if I succeeded. In order to terminate that liability, the board has two options. I mean, one is they can fight it all the way to court and lose or win. That there were in fact no violations in the first place, but if an adverse judicial finding as of that point in time will terminate attorney fee liability, it seems to me. But secondly, they can admit it, and that's entirely within the board's power. They have the sole ability, since there is no record of these meetings, to investigate in the first instance whether they have occurred. And if they publicly disclose the admission of the violation, then I believe at that time attorney fee liability prospective to that point and at least would terminate. But of course that didn't happen in this case, as the only admission occurred following the filing of the complaint and the answer.
Appellee's position seems to be that the July 16th meeting was held before the complaint was filed, and that in effect that there was an admission before the complaint was filed, and therefore there shouldn't be an entitlement to an award of attorney fees.
I think a careful review of the record indicates there was no such admission. There was some public disclosure by their counsel of what counsel believed would be an appropriate remedy should admissions have occurred, very carefully worded not to make any such admission. There were statements in the answer brief in this court that suggested there had been an actual admission, but a close reading of the record indicates no such admission was made.
Your argument that because of the violation of the OML, the open meetings law, the public body can never address that issue again?
Before this court, it is not that position. Initially, we were quite concerned that essentially the fruit of the poisonous tree, these multiple violations, particularly involving one board member's pressure on staff and a staff version of changes to the law, had become too evident. I think possibly that board member should have recused himself in the participation. But ultimately, we're not arguing that there is some sort of per se preclusionary remedy. But I do think that as part of cure, a full disclosure of the circumstances such that the public and perhaps ultimately the court may evaluate the extent of the violation, the extent of the influence the violation and the conduct during those illegal meetings may have had. We're obviously at a disadvantage and always will be as long as illegal meetings continue to take place because there is no record of those proceedings. And the little scraps of information that we have on them is about the best we can do. So we need to create an incentive system that encourages prompt and early disclosure of those violations to the public. And I believe that's when the attorney fee liability issue comes into play.
With respect to the attorney fee request, are fees being sought for any work that was performed after the answer was filed admitting that there had been the violations?
Yes, in the sense that the case continued and we were arguing about remedies, including whether or not we were entitled to attorney fees, which we believe is an important question under the Act.
Okay, but at that point, there were substantive arguments being made against the action that was taken by the board, whether or not.
Pardon me. Those fees for questions related to whether the actions taken by the board at the public meeting exceeded their statutory authority, those fees have been removed from the attorney fee claim. So as an initial matter, the issue of which party had the burden of proof of whether the later meeting constituted either cure or rubber stamp had arisen during the briefing of the motion for summary judgment and was before the district court at oral argument on that motion. But neither the court's order nor Colorado appellate cases interpreting the Act address the burden of proof. We think that this court should follow the Alaska Supreme Court and establish the OMM violator has the burden of establishing that it has cured the violations. We think that the cure allegation fits the classic definition of an affirmative defense, which alleviates liability even if all the factual and legal allegations in the complaint are true concerning the past violations. We think the policy pronouncement of these courts that the OML should be construed as broadly as possible to increase governmental transparency and to protect the ultimate beneficiary, the public, that's in Costilla County and Cole, support this allocation of the burden. And we don't believe that the public can effectively investigate and prove the full extent of the violation and thus the adequacy of any alleged cure precisely because the government prevented them from participating. And that's what's so insidious about the government misconduct in this case. Proof that the July 16th meeting was a rubber stamp includes the virtual identity of the June 7th illegal meeting output and the changes formally adopted July 16th, a board member's discussion just prior to that illegal meeting of an existing minority point of view of a fellow board member. And there really can't be detailed discussions of minority and majority views unless that's strong circumstantial evidence that votes were taken during those illegal meetings. Certainly, everything leading up to a vote occurred. And obviously the board engaged in no substantive discourse as to the detailed language of these multiple drafts that were before it and voted unanimously, thus any factions on the board had mysteriously disappeared between public meetings.
There was opportunity for participation by all the parties and it was a public meeting, and once there were disclosures, and then, I mean, excuse me, there were discussions, opportunity to speak, and public deliberations before the decision.
That's correct. And in that sense, this case has the same facts as the Vero Beach case from Florida, a case where there was additional allowance of public comment. The board sat back, engaged in no substantive discourse as to the language, voted unanimously, and that court struck down the subsequent meeting as or held it to be an inadequate proof of cure.
What is that issue? Is that a fact issue or a legal issue? Because the district court here found that it was not a rubber stamp situation?
I think it's a mixed question of law and fact, but I think that this, it's very important that this court, if it is to recognize the availability of a cure remedy, which has been hinted at or at least sent back to the lower courts for further analysis, it's time for this court to lay down some criteria that, that would be meaningful for government agencies and the public to follow.
Ask you a question. Judge Kopelke asked about whether this is a question of fact or law. You're suggesting one remedy would be to send this back to the trial court. That, in my mind, says, okay, it's a question of fact as to whether there was a rubber stamp or an independent decision. So it's up to us to determine if the findings of fact that the trial court made are sufficient to show that this was not rubber stamping. That's the implication I get from your reference to a possible remedy of sending this back. Why send it back if we are satisfied with the findings?
Well, obviously, our side's not satisfied with the findings. I think the question, though, is it's been long enough where there have been no real rules stated as to what is an adequate cure, whether a cure can exist, and what is an adequate cure. Other cases from other states have started to evaluate various fact patterns, like the Vero Beach case, which we believe is very close to the fact pattern here, and found on appeal that the trial court's decision was incorrect and reversed and remanded. We believe that the judge gave very short shrift and simply said that a mechanical public meeting is sufficient. And we don't believe that that's an adequate searching of the necessary proof of criteria that there's been a substantial reconsideration. To do otherwise would undermine our rule and our corollary about the rubber stamping, which has been found in multiple cases. This court's going to need to elaborate on what does it mean to rubber stamp, etc. And I believe that there is definitely an opportunity for a legal review on the law in that case. I think quickly on the attorney fees, and I'd like to reserve just a bit of time. Clearly, even if there has been a cure, that certainly doesn't immunize an OML violator from the mandatory attorney fee provisions of Section 4029. This court said in Van Alstyne that regardless of the effects of a third properly noticed public meeting, the plaintiffs were entitled to their costs and attorney fees as private attorneys general who, through their exercise of their public spirit and private resources, caused a body to comply with the open meetings law. The definition of a prevailing plaintiff doesn't require a victory on every single issue, and it's clear here that the action of investigating the claims prevented further violations even before the filing of the suit. As it's clear from the evidence on in some board meeting minutes from May, which are in CD pages 307 and 308, it was clear that the board had planned a series of these roundtable meetings. And after the trail users called the violation out from June 7th to their attention, no such meetings were held. They elicited eventually the admission in the answer of the violations. The court found that violation and joined future violations and retained jurisdiction to deal with those future violations. So we think the totality of the circumstances, they induced the admission of the violations and the judicial finding as to the violations, and they prevented future violations. And that's all you need to do under Van Alstyne. I will reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Tim Monahan. I'm a first assistant attorney general with the Colorado Attorney General's Office. My registration number is 16971, appearing on behalf of the appellee here, the Parks Board. I really don't have a great deal of material to provide the court today. I think the materials have been provided in the briefing address adequately the issues that are before the court. However, there are a couple of points that I did want to go over with the court and allow the court to ask any questions it might have with regard to the positions taken by the Parks Board. And the first point is, and setting aside the issue about whether or not the appellants here had properly reserved both the rubber stamping argument and the burden of proof argument for appeal, I really wanted to talk a little bit about just how unfounded their position is with regard to who bears the burden and what is required to show a rubber stamping. Really, in Colorado, it's well established that administrative action is entitled to a presumption of both regularity and validity. And that flows from what I believe is the general separation of the powers doctrine, where the courts are not supposed to interject themselves unnecessarily into the activities of the executive branch. In the June 16th action of the Parks Board that was taken to approve the modifications both to the grant subcommittee and the funding parameters that that grant subcommittee would look at, is entitled to that presumption under Colorado law. Alaska may have a different rule that it applies with regard to its open meetings, but when we talk about Colorado law, we have a well-established presumption of regularity and validity. And it is the challenging party, the appellant here, that bears the burden to show that that action taken at the June 16th meeting was invalid. It is their burden to show that a rubber stamping occurred. It's not the Parks Board's burden to show or prove the negative, that there was no rubber stamping. It's their burden to come forward with the argument and references to the record to establish the invalidity of that particular action. Now, not only did they have that burden, they didn't carry that burden. And under the circumstances presented here, the record is clear that they could not have shown a rubber stamping. And let me explain why that's the case. Colorado, through a series of cases, including Van Alstyne, Bagby, Cole, the Hyde case, all referenced in the briefs, those are the rubber stamping cases that have guided the courts. All of those cases involved boards meeting together and actually acting upon a matter at meetings that were found to be invalid under the open meetings law because they failed to give notice of a particular meeting, or they excluded the public from those discussions. But the key point is that the board took action which at a subsequent meeting it attempted to reaffirm, and those courts found some elements of rubber stamping. And that's not what we have here with the Parks Board. Now, granted, violations of open meetings law are a serious matter, and the Parks Board recognized what it had done in the past and has admitted those violations. But I think if you look at the three violations that were identified here, they don't compare in any way to the violations that took place in Van Alstyne, Bagby, Cole, or Hyde that led the court to find that there'd been a rubber stamping. The April 28th violation was an email by one board member to the other board members transmitting an electronic copy of a proposal that he had provided in hard copy at the meeting of the same day. He made reference to looking forward to the discussion of the issues, but there was no response to that email by any of the other board members, nor was there any evidence of some action taken by the board on that particular proposal. The March 19th violation was another email by the same board member suggesting that another board member attempt to undertake compromises of the issues that are presented before the Parks Board. But again, there was no indication of any action. The board member that was encouraged to undertake action never provided any such compromise at any of the later meetings. And there was a conversation on the telephone with regard to that email, but it was between two board members. A quorum of the Parks Board is three. That's what's required to take action. Those two members couldn't undertake anything to bind the Parks Board moving forward.
Statute refer to two or more members?
It does, Your Honor, and we do not contest that the April 28th, the March 19th, and the June 7th meetings were all meetings under the open meetings law and subject to the requirements. The point here is that they were incapable of making a decision on behalf of the Parks Board that later could be rubber stamped at the June 16th meeting. The June 7th meeting similarly involved just two board members. One board member actively participated in what was a Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation sponsored mediation session. Remember, the Parks Board had directed the division at its May meeting to get together with the constituents, find out what their issues are, try to reach compromises. And that was the purpose behind the June 7th meeting. Now, one board member, as is typical in the case of any issues that are presented to the Parks Board, subject matter areas, one board member who had been assigned the duty to kind of look after OHV issues did participate in that mediation, sat at the mediation table and discussed the issues in trying to help forge some compromise. But that was just as a representative of the board and not a binder of the board. The second board member that was there didn't participate in any of those discussions. Sat, observed, and actually was only there for a portion of that meeting, but did not interact directly with the board member that was participating in the mediation. All of those show those three violations, while the Parks Board admits their violations, the substance of those matters show there was no decision that flows from any of those three illegal meetings that could be rubber stamped at the June or the July 16th meeting of the Parks Board, where they actually adopted the changes to the grant subcommittee and to the elements that drive whether or not there should be certain purposes within grant programs. And in actuality, at that July 16th meeting, the board wasn't acting upon a board proposal or something that the board had put together. It was acting upon the division created proposal that was based upon these mediations, this give and take that they had had with the constituent groups. And council points to certain elements at that July 16th meeting that he believes show that it was a rubber stamping. In actuality, the items that he's identified don't show that there was a rubber stamping. The similarity of the proposals, he says, shows a rubber stamping. Well, they weren't all that similar to begin with. There had been significant modifications made between the division's proposal of June 7th and the actual proposal that went forward on July 16th. They added an additional grant reviewer to the proposal, which hadn't been discussed at the July meeting. So the proposals weren't that similar to begin with. He complains that there was no longer a minority view, which shows that there was some rubber stamping going on. Well, in actuality, if it was a rubber stamping, you would expect the dissenters that had questioned the position before to continue to question. Why would they change their position with regard to the ultimate action taken in July 16th? If anything, a change from some minority view to a unanimous vote shows that there wasn't a rubber stamping either.
I wonder if you could turn from the rubber stamping issue to that of the attorney fee request.
Certainly.
And in that light, we have a situation here where they apparently were going to have additional sessions I guess no indication in the record that those were going to be public meetings. They were alerted, the board was alerted that, to the claimed violations before the complaint was filed, and I think by letter, as I recall. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The court ultimately enters an injunction against further violations of the open meetings law. Aren't there, in any event, results that are directly attributable to the action that was taken by the appellants here? And under the statute, why should they not be entitled to attorney fees it costs, at least as to those actions that resulted in the admission and the perhaps even in the way the cure meeting was conducted?
I don't think so, and here's why.
Okay.
With regard to the prior violations of the open meetings law, this was, granted, a fluid situation that was taking place. The meeting occurred on July 7th. Appellants then questioned it. There was a response back to the appellants by the director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, indicating that, yeah, there were issues raised because there were two members there. He said we didn't mean to. It was inadvertent if we violated the open meetings law, because it was always intended there would only be one active participant.
But he didn't actually admit on behalf of the board that there had been violations of that stage.
To the extent of saying, I hereby admit there was a violation of the open meetings law, no, Your Honor.
Okay.
There wasn't in that letter. And in all truthfulness, with regard to the matters that were discussed at the July 16th meeting, there wasn't that either, where someone stood up and said, there is, in fact, a violation. But under the circumstances, it was quite clear what was transpiring at the meeting. There were issues raised by counsel with regard to all three matters. Through Open Records Act requests, materials had been distributed to them and were in the public realm that established the violations, the emails from April 28th, the email from March 19th. The whole notion of the meeting of June 7th was clear to everyone, including appellants, since representatives of theirs had participated in those meetings. And so when there was the discussion that took place at the July 16th meeting about these issues under the open meetings law and what needed to be done, all of that was quite clear, Your Honor, as to the problems that had been created and what needed to be done to fix those problems. All of that was fixed at the July 16th meeting. It was a properly noticed meeting. It was a properly conducted meeting. The division came forward with its proposal, outlined all the elements of that proposal. Public comments were allowed on that proposal. In fact, public comments by the appellant. And then the board discussed, deliberated, and then acted upon that proposal. Now, certainly, you know, we're somewhat handicapped because we don't have the transcript of a meeting, but we do have the minutes. And the minutes very clearly indicate that the chair of the Parks Board discussed the basis for its action with regard to the proposal in front of it. And certainly, if there was some limited discussion, as appellants have characterized it, it's quite understandable, given that it was a proposal made by the division to the Parks Board. It was intended to reflect compromises between the division and all the constituent groups that were involved in this particular matter before the Parks Board. Certainly, in those circumstances, it's quite understandable that the Parks Board might not sit down and dissect each and every detail. The parties before it had reached a compromise, and they were willing to accept that. And that's within their authority as the Parks Board. I thank the court for its consideration of this matter.
To apply the general presumption of regularity of a government board's action in the face of government's clear misconduct via past open meetings law violations, would read the prohibition against rubber stamping out of existence. It is a plaintiff's obligation under the Act to show that open meetings law violations occurred in the first instance. After that, it will be the responsibility of the government OML violator to prove that a cure occurred if it did. To rule otherwise will essentially remove any sanction for prior violations, to hide behind the presumption of regularity in the face of conceded government misconduct and a statute that's designed for that. Thank you.
Your ask will stand submitted. We will now hear the second case.